This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with peace activist Anne Wright.
She just returned from a mission to Russia, and we'll talk about the grave threat, perhaps a nuclear threat, that American aggression on the Russian border has brought to all of us.
Professor Robin Anderson joins us to talk about Great Britain's newly released Chilcot Report.
This report shows how George W. Bush's counterpart, Tony Blair, knew the war against Iraq was cooked up. And the implication is George W. Bush knew it too.
New York attorney Roger Wareham joins us to talk about his representation of Delron Small and about police killings of civilians in general.
The racism and polarization in this society is there for all to see, and it behooves all of us to be on the side of the black movement in America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Noam Chomsky has recently written with alarm about two threats facing humanity: climate change and nuclear war. The likelihood of a nuclear war has increased, he wrote, because of NATO military buildup and expansion east to the Russian border, which thus breaks a promise the U.S. made with Russia when East and West Germany were unified. Moreover, under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the United States spent $5 billion in successfully overthrowing the democratically elected government of the Ukraine, a country bordering Russia on its southwestern frontier. Joining us today is peace activist Anne Wright, who has just returned from Russia. Wright served in the U.S. Army for 25 years and then in the diplomatic corps. She resigned over the U.S. war against Iraq. Anne Wright, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, tell us a bit about yourself and why you were recently in Russia.
Well, I am a retired U.S. Army colonel. I spent 29 years in the military. I was also a U.S. diplomat for 16 years. I resigned in 2003 in opposition to the war in Iraq. And since then, I've been working with a lot of the people on the disorder side of what you all talk about, of the people that are really challenging our government and its policies. And the reason that 20 of us went to Russia just in the middle part of June was to check on what was going on. Our government's telling us that Russia is a very dangerous country and that its actions are endangering the security of the world. And several of us are highly suspicious of some of these government claims. So we took 20 people to Russia to talk to Russians about what their perceptions were of what was happening.
And how long were you there?
We were there about 17 days, a long time for a group of 20 people to be together, quite honestly. But we had some very, very great people who've done a lot of work in the peace community in the United States, and it turned out to be a really good team together.
What we're concerned about is the U.S.-led NATO, the North American Treaty Organization, the NATO military buildup right on the border of Russia. When you were there having discussions with these people, what was their feelings about that?
Well, the Russian people are going like, why are you guys doing this? I mean, we haven't provoked you, although the West will say, well, it's the actions of Russia in the annexation of Crimea that has given everybody such concern. Of course, the Russians always say, and many people in the United States, that let's look at what actually happened in the Ukraine, that indeed it was a U.S.-sponsored coup that threw out Russian-leaning government, an elected government, but that had certainly had more ties to Russia than it did to the West. And the West wanted Ukraine to come over into the EU and into NATO. And so here was this coup that we now know that our Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, was commenting about our guy Yats and, pejorative word toward the EU because they weren't moving fast enough on trying to consolidate things for the West and Ukraine. But to the Russians, I mean, Ukraine housed in Crimea its southern fleet on the Black Sea. And so for the Ukraine to go into a right-wing nationalist party put in jeopardy, they felt, their military base in Crimea.
You know, it should be pointed out that after the successful coup, the first fascists in a government since World War II were installed in the Ukraine. And I think it should also be pointed out that Victoria Nuland was the Undersecretary of State working for Hillary Clinton, who is likely to become the next president. And this military buildup on the borders of Russia happened under Hillary Clinton. So knowing that, what did the Russians have to say? Where did you go? Who did you talk to? And what do they feel about things?
Well, we went to four different areas in Russia. We started out in Moscow, then we went down to the Crimea. We spent 5 days in the Crimea. We were the first group of Americans to have been in the Crimea in 2 years because of U.S. and EU sanctions on not only Russia, but specifically on the Crimean for having the audacity to have a referendum where 80% of the people in Crimea voted and 97% voted to reunite with Russia. So we talked with lots of people there, and we talked with people there who, well, the majority of people in Crimea are ethnic Russians, and there are some Tatars that are there also. There are Ukrainians that live there. We talked to both the Russians who said, yes, we should want to reunite with Russia. And we talked to some people who said, no, we shouldn't have reunited. So we talked to a wide range there. Then we went across even further to the east to Kazanrod, to the fourth largest city in Russia, talked with the people there. Then we went to St. Petersburg and talked with lots of people there. We talked with a variety of folks, and an interesting part of that we normally, as part of the peace community, generally don't talk to people in, like, the business community. But this trip was organized through a group called the Center for Citizen Initiatives, which over the last 30 years has taken over 7,000 Americans to Russia, starting back in the 80s when there was this, you know, the confrontation during the Cold War. And then they started bringing Russians to the United States. And when you read a book that is written by the woman that organized all this, her name's Sharon Tennyson. She's 80 years old. She lives in San Francisco. And when you look at her book called The Power of Impossible Ideas, now how about that for a title? But when you see the index of it, at the back of it, of all of the listings of all of the civic clubs in America who have sponsored Russians coming to the United States to live in their communities, live in their homes, be a part of their community, it's enormous. And it shows that the people-to-people relationships are so important. And we, the people, have to calm down the governments and these crazy moves toward military confrontation, which certainly can go into war.
We so rarely hear about those one-on-one relationships.
Yeah, and there have been thousands of them. If you look in the index, the Kiwanis clubs and Rotary clubs of the United States were key members of bringing Russians to live in the communities.
And what kind of weapons is NATO deploying?
Well, NATO has this Aegis missile defense system that is causing the Russians great angst. Initially, it was to counter the Iranian missile problem. But now that the Iranians have signed a nuclear program, to no nuclear advancement or anything, all of a sudden now the missiles seem to be turned toward Russia. And the Russians are going, now, wait a minute, what are you guys doing? And why are you having all these military exercises right on our border? The largest military exercises, particularly for Poland, since the Cold War, when Poland was a part of the Warsaw Pact, for God's sakes. This year, there have been major military exercises in Poland, in Bulgaria, along the Baltic states, all of which the Russians are saying, why are you guys doing this? Why are you doing this?
The magazine, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, has on the front cover a clock, and the hands of the clock are approaching midnight. And if it's more dangerous, the hands get closer to midnight, and if there's some relaxation and tensions, the hands drop back. But just recently, they moved those hands way forward. Are you in agreement with that?
Well, yes, because you never can tell what may happen when you have these militaries, the NATO militaries, not just the U.S., but all of the NATO countries combining into this big military conglomerate facing off Russia. And, you know, some kid may inadvertently start firing weapons and somebody then has to return fire, and then it just escalates. And when you have two nuclear entities, the United States and NATO, and the Russians, I mean, this thing could get out of control very, very quickly.
It's interesting. I'm thinking of a popular culture, the television show The Americans, about Russian spies living in this country and the propaganda that really we're, I think, renewing so many years after the Cold War. We wanted to know where else you visited, Anne, besides Russia, and why.
Well, I just returned from Poland. After Russia, I went into Poland and to be there during the NATO summit. And what we had as an alternative to the NATO summit, we had 150 people from 15 countries that were there to challenge NATO's rhetoric about why Russia is the great enemy right now and all of the military exercises that they're having. I also had, before I went to Russia, I was in South Korea at the Women's Peace Walk along the Demilitarized Zone there, and then to a UN conference for non-governmental organizations, a worldwide conference held in Korea, and then down to Jeju Island, the site of a new naval base built by the South Koreans under great protest by the people of Jeju Island. But it's to home port the Aegis missile system on naval destroyers for the U.S. and for South Korea. From there, I went on up to Japan, went down to Okinawa, the southernmost island where 79% of all U.S. military bases in Japan are located on that island, to include the very contentious Hanoko base where the U.S., not the Japanese, but the U.S. government wants to build runways out into the pristine Pacific Ocean. And because of great citizen activism and the very strong stance of the governor of Okinawa, who has sued the national government of Japan on environmental issues, the destruction of that bay has been at least temporarily stalled.
Is your group going to issue a written report that listeners can access if they want?
Well, each one of us on the trip to Russia have been writing our own articles. Ray McGovern has already written his, David Hartzo's written, Kathy Kelly has written, Elizabeth Murray. We all will be writing individual reports on our perceptions while we were there. And I've also written reports on my trip to South Korea and to Japan and the citizen activism going on against the increase of militarization of both of those countries as the U.S. does its pivot to Asia and the Pacific.
How can listeners access those reports, Anne?
Well, if they go on to my particular website, which is voicesofconscience.com, all of the ones that I have listed are there. And then also on the website for the Center for Citizen Initiatives, they will be listing all of the articles that have been written by members of our delegation.
We'll put links to both of those on our website.
Thank you.
What scares me and Heidi is both the prospect of Trump getting elected and the prospect of Hillary Clinton, who has a track record in this respect, of her getting elected. What are you telling people about what they should be doing to be active for peace?
Well, it certainly is a great dilemma that we have facing us. I mean, each one of those candidates has so much baggage with them. And Hillary Clinton, who has been so ready to use the U.S. military in so many places in the world, and then Donald Trump, whose rhetoric just can get so crazy. To his credit, he's at least said he would talk to President Putin of Russia, although I don't know what he would say to him quite, but
let's cut a deal.
Yeah. Well, and that's what we need to be doing. Let's cut a deal. I mean, that's what this is all about, the compromise among nations about their own national security to But to compromise so that no one's national security is threatened by the other. So it is a real dilemma. Of course, we've got two other candidates are running, Jill Stein of the Green Party, who, when you read the platform of the Green Party, is kind of the platform that I agree with.
And we've had Jill on.
Yes, and she's an excellent person who has, of course, been iced out by the two major political parties of our country. We definitely need a parliamentary system in our country so that two parties don't dominate the entire political spectrum and push everybody that wants to challenge it totally out.
Before we let you go, Ann, because we're running out of our allotted time, can you tell us what you and the other people like Ray McGovern have been doing since you came back from your trip over to Russia?
Well, we've been writing and being on radio shows and television shows and things like that. And the main, if you really look at a lot of the writing that's coming out by seasoned government employees, Phil Garibaldi, who's with the Center for National Interest, you look at Ray McGovern, there's a whole series of people who've spent decades in our government, and they are all warning against this U.S. government rhetoric demonizing and vilifying Russia. So we really need to encourage people to read the alternative and not listen to our television stations, who are nothing, tragically now, more than just the mouthpieces for our government.
Do you have any other projects underway?
Well, another project that I'm working on is Women's Boat to Gaza. The Women's Boat to Gaza is an initiative that we have for the Gaza Freedom Flotilla Coalition that's been sending boats to Gaza since 2008 as a way to bring attention, international attention, to the ongoing Israeli naval blockade of Gaza. And, of course, you remember that in 2008 and 2009, the Free Gaza Movement sent small little boats in, and actually a couple of them did get into Gaza. And then in 2010, the six-ship flotilla, including the Mavi Marmara from Turkey, all six ships being attacked by the Israeli Defense Forces, and 10 people being killed, to include one 17-year-old American citizen, Furgan Doan. And then followed the next year by the 10-boat Gaza flotilla that the Israelis were able to convince the Greek government not to let sail from the shores. And then in 2015, we had four boats that sailed toward Gaza, one of them being actually attacked and taken by the IDF into Israel. And this year, as a kind of a twist on this whole thing, we've decided that we're sending a woman's boat. The captain, the crew, and all the passengers will be women on board. And Mairead McGuire, the Nobel Peace Laureate, who's been on several of these boats to Gaza and has been deported numerous times from Israel, will be on board. And here from the United States, our delegate is Naomi Wallace, a playwright who has done several plays about the Palestinian challenges that Palestinians face. So we will be having at least one boat and hopefully two, depending on our fundraising. And if you just Google Women's Boat to Gaza, we would appreciate any consideration for helping us get these boats so we can sail to challenge the Israeli blockade of Gaza.
It's so great that you're doing that, Ann. I just read today that the Democratic Party platform refuses to say anything about rebuilding Gaza, which of course was destroyed, and refuses to condemn the settlement building of the Israelis. And the conclusion of the article I read was that the Democratic platform is actually to the right of the Republican platform. So you're doing what you're doing with the Women's Boat to Gaza is a wonderful thing, and we wish you every success.
You're all an inspiration to us, Ann. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you all. And in memory of dear Michael Ratner, thank you. Keep on with this great show, Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's great.
Great Britain has just released the so-called Chilcot Report. It exposes the role of British Prime Minister Tony Blair in leading his country into the war against Iraq, joining the United States in illegally overthrowing Saddam Hussein and beginning a war that has been ongoing since 2004. It has destroyed that country and also destabilized the Middle East, leading to wars in Libya, Syria, and Yemen. The Chilcot Report reinforces the observation of Robert Breedlove, head of MI5, the British CIA, after his visit to the USA before the war began, that the United States was dishonestly manufacturing so-called intelligence, and that Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction and posed absolutely no danger. Joining us to discuss the Chilcot Report is Professor Robin Anderson. She teaches communications at Fordham University in New York and writes for Fairness and Accuracy in Media, FAIR, the media watchdog group. Robin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Heidi. It's great to be here.
Robin, the so-called Chilcot Report just came out. Can you tell our listeners what it is and what it included?
The Chilcot Report is an investigation into the claims that the British government made about their reasons for going into Iraq with the U.S. And the Chilcot Report came out about a week and a half ago and revealed and exposed to the British and American publics that the intelligence was flawed, that Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction. In fact, this was Blair's idea to go along with the Bush administration very early on, but it was not and ever confirmed by the Joint Intelligence Committee in Britain that there was a real reason to invade Iraq.
With respect to the, quote, flawed intelligence, there was a memo called the Downing Street memo. A man named Breedlove, who was the head of MI5, which is the British equivalent of the CIA, had gone to the United States and discussed weapons of mass destruction and the threat that Saddam Hussein posed. And Breedlove came back to England and talked about what he had found out. Tell us what he found out about the intelligence on Saddam Hussein.
What he found out after speaking to his American counterparts in the U.S. administration was basically that right after 9/11, Bush and the administration had decided to invade Iraq as early as December 2001. And basically, he at that point also had kind of signed on. When Breedlove went, he confirmed that the Washington people confirmed that that's what they're doing, and they told him and he how they were going to manipulate the intelligence to basically pull the wool over the eyes of the American public, claiming that he had weapons of mass destruction. So Breedlove comes back to the British cabinet and Blair, and in the memo, in the minutes of that meeting, he says the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. And that's what the Downing Street memo told folks, and it was made public on May 1st, 2005, and the British press published it widely.
One of the most shameful things that happened after the war against Iraq was initiated was Bush at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I wanted you to describe what Bush was doing in front of 1,500 of the key American media people in the United States. What did Bush do at the White House Correspondents' Dinner?
Right, Michael. This was in March of 2004. Bush was the speaker, and he had a slideshow up, and it showed him looking behind the curtains in his office under the desk, and he was providing a little soundtrack, and he was saying, "Gosh, where are those weapons of mass destruction? They've got to be here somewhere. Maybe they're over here. No, no weapons over there." And at the Radio and Television Correspondents Association dinner, everyone laughed and gave him great applause. And nobody thought that it was really horrible.
Robin, was Bush ever confronted with the Downing Street memo? And if so, what did he say in response?
he was. Blair came over about 6 weeks after the memo was published. Now, the U.S. media had not reported on the memo at all. They just simply ignored it. A journalist had the nerve to ask Bush 6 weeks after the memo, when Blair was in town, what do you think, Mr. Bush, of the Downing Street memo? And he was kind of completely unprepared, a little bit taken aback, and said, oh, but wait a minute, any idea that we made up our minds to go in with the military and take out Saddam Hussein, nothing could be further from the truth.
When Bush said, quote, nobody wants to commit military into combat, it's the last option, would you characterize that as a lie?
Yes, absolutely. We know now that it was absolutely a lie. Oddly enough, it was around this issue, the New York Review of Books, a piece by Mark Danner, that really laid it out, and he did this in June of 2005, and it's really all in the timing. And what Danner lays out is the way in which the administration decided to give Saddam Hussein an ultimatum and say, if you don't let weapons inspectors in, we'll have to invade. So what they were doing there is actually laying out a legal justification, and they were actually saying in the memos and what has been revealed subsequently is, well, if he could actually refuse the UN inspectors, and they were kind of hoping that he would do that. And so what Danner says is there, thus the U.S. inspectors, the UN inspectors looking for weapons of mass destruction, was introduced not as a means to avoid war, but as Bush repeatedly assured Americans, but it was a means to make war possible.
Do you think American journalists were complicit in this lie?
That kind of, Heidi, reveals itself with their response once the Downing Street memo did start to get some play in the U.S. press after the press conference with Bush and Blair. And there, then, you know, people had called in and say they had written to the New York Times, to the Washington Post. Fair had done a lot of work around this, saying, why isn't this memo news? Why? What are you trying to hide? And so weeks later, when they started, actually did start to report on it, the reason they didn't report on it, they said, was because the Downing Street memo was not news. They said, we knew all of this at the time. And they said everybody in Washington, including journalists, knew that the claim that to Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction was a lie. For example, the New York Times says, and this is, you know, June 2005, 3 years ago, the near unanimous conventional wisdom in Washington held that Mr. Bush was determined to topple Saddam Hussein by any means necessary. And even Andrea Mitchell of NBC said you'd have to be brain dead not to know what the White House was doing then. Yet, this did not inform reporting at the time. For example, in March of 2003, Andrea Mitchell presents the president's remarks as truthful articulations of his intention, saying Bush's dealings with the UN were part of the diplomatic campaign to avoid war. So what the reporters were telling their readers, they were giving the administration at face value everything that they were saying about Saddam needing to come out because he had weapons of mass destruction. And then 2 years later, they say, oh, no, we all knew that that was a lie.
Professor Anderson, with respect to the Nuremberg trials, which were held in Nuremberg, Germany, after the conclusion of World War II, Hitler and a number of high-ranking German officers and governmental officials were found guilty at Nuremberg of the crime of aggressive war. And aggressive war was termed the greatest of all crimes because it includes within it all other crimes. Would you assess America's war against Iraq as an aggressive war?
Oh, absolutely. And what this incident shows about the excuses is that, well, I think Bush and Rumsfeld and the gang knew full well that they were going to violate what, since the Nuremberg trials, had established throughout the latter half of the 20th century were Geneva Conventions and rules of war that laid in place basic international law that said you can't go in without just cause and justification. And, of course, you know that Clinton signed on to that in 1996. So this was a deliberate attempt to invade a country, which is the most grand violation of civil liberties, human rights, and action of war. And they needed an excuse, and that's what they did.
Do you believe Clinton and the United States were removing Gaddafi from power in Libya was a continuation of the same policies Bush began in Iraq?
Absolutely. Bush and company tried to give three reasons. It was weapons of mass destruction, the fact that that Saddam Hussein had engaged in mass murder, and that he was involved in terrorism. The other two didn't really stick, so that's why they stuck with weapons of mass destruction. But it was still, in a sense, a quote-unquote humanitarian war, if you will, because they were supposed to be preventing a lot of death. Clinton and Samantha Powers and Susan Rice convinced the Obama administration in 2011 to bomb Gaddafi and basically engage in regime change there based on a humanitarian rationale that he was attacking the Arab Spring and that there was going to be a massacre. You can hear how this rings similar to the weapons of mass destruction. Subsequently, we know what happened in Libya. Even though Clinton gloated at the time to CBS, we came, we saw, he died in a horrible interview. But we know now that that hundreds of thousands of refugees have been created, massive human rights violations all throughout the region, and that guns went from Libya into Mali, Chad, Nigeria, and Syria. And Libya is on the Mediterranean, 300 miles from Europe. So it's a disaster. And that was a quote-unquote humanitarian intervention.
Do you think that the war could not have been prosecuted but for the help of the media?
Absolutely, and that's what's so interesting, Michael, about the whole thing. The good news is, if you recall, we had more demonstrations around the world, 8 million people demonstrating against the war before it started, than any war in history. And a civilian population, a peaceful civilian population, really doesn't want to go to war. You actually really have to convince them. That's what we know now about democracy and war propaganda. And it's a cycle. You know, you beat the drums to war, then with the demonization and all of the other press strategies, and then it turns into a disaster, and then everyone's quite contrite, or not.
Let's shift our focus a little bit to Syria, which is in the middle of a hot war. What is Clinton's policy towards Syria?
Clinton's stated policy on Syria, and she's been pushing for this, is to create a no-fly zone over Syria. Many analysts think that would be very, very dangerous because it would engage the Russians. And, of course, as you know, Putin has nuclear weapons, and it could easily lead to a wider, you know, World War III-type confrontation with nuclear weapons.
If you take at face value what we've been reading in the media lately about the dangers of Russia, you think that Russia is actually a threat to the United States. Do you believe that that's the case? And what do you think is playing out here?
Well, I think we know from 2009, from a WikiLeaks memo, that NATO talked about pushing right up to Russia's western borders, that this was a planned policy, and I think that's what played out in the Ukraine. Subsequently, the narrative, the media narrative that's now been accepted and promoted by NATO, that Putin is a terrible leader and he's very aggressive and he's going to do all of these horrible things, is really about, again, the fact that Russia remains a power, though it's not a superpower, and conflicts frequently with the United States on foreign policy, and particularly oil, and is a competing large interest with China. So the U.S. media narrative comes right from NATO that is condemning and really beating the drums against Putin.
Professor Robin Anderson, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Robin. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So long.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is investigating an off-duty NYPD officer's fatal shooting of 37-year-old Delron Small in Brooklyn after he, his girlfriend, and three children celebrated the 4th of July holiday. Shortly after midnight, Small and an undercover officer driving his personal vehicle were involved in a traffic dispute. The officer shot three times with his service weapon, killing Small. Authorities quickly justified the attack by claiming Small had punched Isaacs in the face. But surveillance footage later released showed that the police had lied about the incident and showed that Small was shot within 1 second after approaching Isaacs' unmarked car. Zaquana Albert, Small's girlfriend, witnessed the attack from the car along with her 4-month-old child. Recently, the NYPD has announced that it has stripped Isaacs of his weapon and placed him on modified duty. Here to talk about the case is Small's attorney, Roger Wareham. A longtime human rights lawyer, Roger has represented many black political prisoners in federal lawsuits across the country, and he was co-counsel in representing three of the young men wrongfully convicted in the New York Central Park jogger case. Roger, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad and honored to be back.
Roger, please tell us what happened to your client, Mr. Small.
Well, Delron Small was another victim of white supremacist ideology as embodied in the law enforcement. On the morning of July 4th, he was driving with his girlfriend, his 4-month-old son, and his girlfriend's daughter back from a barbecue, and they were cut off by a car. I think it was either maybe twice. And when they came to a light, Mr. Small got out of his car, walked across two lanes and up to the driver of the car that had cut him off, you know, to tell him, you know, I have my family in the car. It's dangerous. What you're driving is dangerous. He got to the car, and the driver of the car shot him three times. At that point, no one knew it was a police officer. He staggered back a few steps and fell down to the ground. And so when the reports came out, the police officer, to justify his killing, said that Delron Small had been punching him in his head, and then he had responded by firing. And that morning, State Assemblyman Charles Barron, City Councilman Inez Barron, and I were there that morning. State Assemblyman Charles Barron had received a call around what was happening, so we went to the scene to, you know, to talk with the family to make sure that, you know, they didn't make any statements that might not work to their advantage. And we had a press conference that morning, and I emphasized at that point, I didn't believe the officer's account, but, you know, just because they lie. But even if that account were true, it was not a justification for the use of deadly force. Because somebody punching you and to respond with a shooting them, there's no justification for it, particularly when the person who allegedly was punching him was in the street. And he was behind the wheel of a car. All he had to do was roll up the window or drive off, and that whole incident could have been avoided. But it got worse as the week went on, and finally a video came out. It was very interesting because after the killings in Baton Rouge and Minnesota, the news spoke about that those had been the only two police killings that week. It was as if there's no video, then it's not worth mentioning that a police officer killed an unarmed black man. But the video came out on Friday the 8th. And what the video showed was that Mr. Small got out of his car and walked across past another car and up to the officer's car. He walks up to it, and then the next thing you see him, he's staggering backwards. And then he walks a few steps, and then he falls down between two parked cars. And then the part that, to me, was like really indicative of just the complete contempt that law enforcement has for black life. The cop, I mean, he's in plain clothes. Nobody, like I said, no one knew he was a cop, gets out of his car. He casually strolls over. I mean, there's no sense of urgency, no sense of panic, no sense of what have I done. He casually strolls over to where Mr. Small had fallen to the ground. He looks down at him. I mean, he doesn't bend down. He doesn't do anything to touch him or to see if there's a pulse, if he's still alive. He looks down at him, turns around, and walks casually back to his car and pulls out a phone and makes a phone call. Now, I don't know if that was a 911 call or that was to his union rep, but to me it was just so indicative of just the utter contempt, the disdain police officers have internalized around dealing with people from the black and brown community. And so the New York State Attorney General, Schneiderman, has taken over the investigation. He had two of his people there that morning, and they were just, you know, beginning to get evidence. The evidence they got had to come from the NYPD because they do not have a separate crime scene unit. So the obligation, supposedly, of the NYPD was to turn over to the New York State Attorney General any information they got, videos, witnesses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I don't know if they've done that, but the New York State Attorney General's office has taken over the investigation of this matter, so it's not in the hands of the local district attorney, Ken Thompson.
Roger, I want to clarify, the video that surfaced, was that a private citizen recording the events?
Well, you know, it's not clear, and it surfaced in, of all places, the New York Post. The New York Post, which is a bastion of police support, got the video first and posted it. They didn't say where it came from. It might have been a surveillance camera in one of the stores along the street, but I'm not sure of the source. But it's very clear from the video that Mr. Small hadn't thrown any punches and that he walked up to it, and the next thing he had been shot. So it's not clear. There may be more videos. The police were canvassing the area. You know, I think because there was so much publicity at the beginning, they wouldn't be able to do what the police in Baton Rouge allegedly did, which was they took the camera, the video, the whole thing of the man whose store in front of which Alton was killed, and took all of it. And unfortunately for the police, they didn't know that the person had also been taping it on his phone. They took his phone, but apparently they didn't check it, and they gave it back to him.
Since 2014, there have been many murders of black citizens, and there have been videos of these murders, and I can't think of an instance where any of these policemen killers were brought to justice. Do you think that because of that, videos but no justice, it emboldens the cops?
Yes, certainly. I think, you know, everyone thought that the use of video would certainly enhance the prosecution of cops who commit crimes and discourage them from committing those crimes. But since the response of law enforcement and the criminal justice system has been, it doesn't make any difference. You know, it's like there's a scene in the movie The Fugitive when Harrison Ford is being chased by Tommy Lee Jones, and he's at the edge of a cave where there's a big waterfall, and he's like trapped, and he says to Tommy Lee Jones, he says, "Look, I didn't do it." Tommy Lee Jones says, "I don't care."
Right.
That's the attitude of law enforcement. We got a video. I don't care. You know, we thought with Eric Garner that was going to be a sure prosecution. With Tamir Rice, that would be a sure prosecution. But we should have known. There was a video of Rodney King, and it took a rebellion for there to be a prosecution, because the first one resulted in an acquittal. So, you know, I was one of the attorneys on the Central Park 5 case, and one of the things we emphasized in terms of trying to prevent that type of miscarriage of justice in the future was that there needed to be videotaping of the entire encounter with the police department. But in a system that's skewed towards the presumption of guilt, videotapes are helpful, but they're certainly not a guarantee. And as I said, even the reporting of this case, it was almost totally ignored on national media until the video surfaced. So, you know, with this case, we'll see what Schneiderman does with it. You know, one would think that this would be a slam dunk, but the politics, a lot of politics always intervene in the process of blind justice.
Roger, can you speak briefly about the role that the police officers' union generally assumes in this kind of case?
Well, the police officers' union generally assumes the posture of defending their members, right or wrong. And surprisingly, I haven't heard any statements yet from the police officers' union around this. And it may be this is so blatant and the officer's black that maybe they're going to, you know, hang them out to dry. But they generally take the position of defending the officers. And, you know, I think they were there for Liang in the Gurley shooting. And, you know, this harks back to the question that Mike asked. Even in the rare instance when there is a conviction, as in the Gurley, Kai Gurley shooting and with Peter Liang, the district attorney recommended that there be no jail time for a crime for which he could have been sentenced up to 15 years. So the signal that the criminal justice system continues to give to the police is that you can do anything in these communities and we will not punish you. So that, you know, if somebody comes up to your window after you cut them off, instead of the response of either talking with them about it or rolling up your window, you shoot them because your attitude is, what's going to happen? So I think that's the attitude we have to deal with, and it's not simply in New York, it's across the country. You know, I was having a discussion with someone around the militarization of the police departments across the country in terms of just all the surplus weapons that have been distributed to police departments around the country and that we saw exhibited last year in Little Ferguson, Missouri, when protests broke out, and then they were dealing with a military force. It's not simply the distribution of the weapons that turns it into a military force. It's the mentality that accompanies the distribution of those weapons. And so a police department, which is supposedly a paramilitary force at best, adopts the mentality of an army. And if they're an army, they're out there dealing in the enemy's community, and the enemy is us. And so, you know, they don't see themselves, even the black ones. You know, it's just like being a black soldier in Iraq or Afghanistan. Once you've internalized, or in Vietnam many years ago, once you've internalized that someone's the enemy, then you deal with them the way you deal with enemies. And I think that's part of the cancer that's responsible for, I wouldn't even say it's epidemic or spate. I think it's really the question of the videos have made it more real and made it harder for them to just say it was an accident, because someone was saying if there had been no video of the Eric Garner shooting, not shooting, the Eric Garner choking, then they would have said, oh, he was just an overweight person whose heart gave out on him.
How does the fact that this was an unmarked car and an officer not in uniform impact or sort of weigh in the possible outcome of this case?
That's something I'm looking at. I'm not sure, because there was something I was just reading where someone had asked the NYPD around, is there protocol that once an off-duty officer pulls his gun, then he's back on duty? It's almost as if they're never off-duty. You know, they might be off-duty in terms of not being at work, but that they're always on duty. So what's the protocol in terms of are they liable? Is the union going to represent them? Is the city going to indemnify them? Who's going to represent them? That's an issue that we're looking at right now. But one would think that they would always be responsible for what they do.
And also the fact that Mr. Small had no idea this was a police officer. So
right, right. It,
yeah.
Yeah, as far as we know, he never even said, back up, I'm a police officer.
Right, right. But,
I mean, I don't know if that would have made a difference in terms of what Mr. Small did, because also Mr. Small did, as far as we know, was to just talk to him about or shout at him about his reckless driving. And so the fact that he was a police officer, but I'm sure Mr. Small never thought that even if he had known he was a police officer, that he would be facing an execution.
Roger, I quite agree with your description of the police in the black community, which is really a ghetto of performing the service of the powers that be as occupying force in the community. And I wanted to ask you about the shooting by a black Army veteran of 11 police officers in Dallas. Five were killed, and there was a Black Lives Matter protest that was going on at the time. And a former congressman from Texas, a man named Joe Walsh, said, "This is war. Watch out, Obama. Watch out, Black Lives Matter. Real America is coming after you." What do you think is going on in this country with respect to the polarization that seems to be unfolding?
Well, I think, one, in respect to the Joe Walsh statement, I would have thought he would have been arrested by the Secret Service already for threatening the life of the President of the United
really?
States. Because that was clearly a threat. Those are the kind of things that people get arrested for. You know, you're not supposed to threaten the President of the United States. But I think it's a reflection of the depth and boldness of the racism, that people are making statements that 20 years ago they would have thought a second before they made it. And I think it's a reflection of that. This is just real blatant racism. I mean, it's tied to the economic crisis that the country is in, and people grasping for explanations for why the quality of their life is declining and doesn't appear to be better for their children. And part of the default explanation in this country has always been that it's black people's fault. And so to divert people from the concentration of wealth and the sheer greed, the inexhaustible greed of capitalism that is responsible for the decline in the quality of their lives, they're looking for black folks and Muslims and immigrants as explanations. And so that if you talk about the gap has always existed, the gap both in terms of the economic and quality of life. I think what's coming out is just the people saying what they've been thinking, people acting on what they've been thinking. And it doesn't bode well, particularly for the ostensible or the targeted scapegoats. So when you get Dallas, and it never ceases to amaze how the system is able to flip the script. Officers who were there to protect the protesters. Now, first of all, I didn't think the officers. Who were the officers there to protect the protesters against? The officers were there to monitor the protest to make sure that it stayed peaceful. They were there to protect the property of whatever part of Dallas the demonstration was going on. But there had been no threats against the protesters unless it was from the police. So that's the first thing, to just color people's perception of what's going on. The officers who were shot, they were on duty. And what the country doesn't want to deal with, and so they reduce it to the portraits of the individuals who were shot and what they represented, and not them as representatives of an occupying force. Because I'm sure that Micah Xavier Johnson didn't know any of them individually. He was dealing with, I think, them the same way as he was trained to deal with the enemy in Afghanistan. And unfortunately, it's all the things we've discussed heretofore that created, in my view, a Micah Johnson. I know they now want to portray him as he's a disturbed individual, and he may have been, but the Rodney Kings, the Tamir Rices, the Trayvon Martins, the Eric Garners, all these cases where black people have been killed by law enforcement or white vigilantes and have never been brought to account for that creates the conditions that produces a Micah Johnson. Because when you take every means of redress away from a people, what's left? And the hypocrisy of a lot of these commentators is that they act as if U.S. society is a peaceful society. The birth of U.S. society was violent. The genocide of the indigenous population that made the U.S. expansion possible was violent. The transatlantic slave trade and slavery was violent. You know, Rap Brown, who is now known as Jamil Alameen, Imam Jamil Alameen, once said, you know, violence is as American as cherry pie. So Micah Johnson is not outside of that. But if you keep creating those conditions, you know, the poem by Langston Hughes, What Happens to a Dream Deferred? Does it, you know, shrivel up like a raisin in the sun, or does it explode? Well, I think Micah Johnson represented that explosion. And unless this country begins to bring these officers who have committed crimes and murders to account, there'll be more Micah Johnsons, because people just they just explode.
Roger, how can our listeners help the small family in their pursuit of justice?
I think the small family wants justice for their son, brother, child, father, uncle, which in this instance would be the arrest, which to me is inexplicable why this officer still hasn't been arrested. The arrest, the indictment, a successful prosecution and conviction, and jail time for Wayne Isaacs, who is the officer who murdered Delron Small. But one thing about the family, which, you know, their vision is larger than simply the tragedy that they've experienced. And, you know, in all the press conferences and all the public statements, they've put Delron Small's murder in the same category as Baton Rouge and Minnesota and Eric Garner and the other ones that where there was no justice brought, and said that they want to see justice in all these cases. And so in the particular of Delron Small, it's to put as much pressure as possible on District Attorney Schneiderman's office to make sure that they carry out that investigation, that arrest, that prosecution, getting a conviction, and making sure that Isaacs goes to jail. I mean, that's something that people can do. They can write the State Attorney General and let them know that we're watching this. So that's something that answers that question. You know, I think the broader question of how do you deal with the question of institutional racism and white supremacy, which when it gets played out with people who have a license to kill, which is basically what the criminal justice system has awarded law enforcement, is a broader question of pressure on society and, you know, and a revolutionary change in society. But we've got to push all the buttons before we get to that.
Well, Roger, you're pushing many buttons, and we appreciate that.
We greatly appreciate what you do, Roger. You're just a wonderful attorney and person, and we're so grateful for you coming on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Take care, Roger.
Good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.